few weeks ago, I was on my summer vacation with my wife, Rebecca, our grandson, Eugene, and Rebecca's service dog, Bentley. And we vacationed up to beautiful Arcata, California, which is home of the redwoods and glorious beaches. Now, we have bought Eugene a metal detector, you know, those long ones that you go along the beach looking for treasure with. And it was his 10th birthday, 10 years old. And so one day we all slept up to a place called Clam Beach, which is right maybe 10 miles north of Arcata. So we all jumped out of the car, went to this beach, which, you know, wasn't very crowded. And Eugene took his metal detector and would sound off every time we'd hit a nail or some other metallic object. And then he'd gather the sand with a trowel and put it through a sifter. And I have a picture of that, since I was the court photographer. You can sort of see Eugene and Bentley. Now, being the photographer, I was like completely absorbed with getting the perfect shot, the right frame for this picture. Turned out pretty well, I think. Unfortunately, later that afternoon, Bentley, the service dog, our service dog, got sick, and he was like puking and had diarrhea and just feeling miserable. And that night kept us up all night long. So that morning, we looked in, you know, YP for local vet, since we didn't know anyone there, and took Bentley to the veterinarian. Now, the vet decided immediately to take an x-ray, and to her amazement, name's Dr. Schroeder, she found out that Bentley was filled with sand from his stomach all the way through his intestines. And they had never seen anything like that, you know, in a little dog. And she called in all the other vet assistants, us, to show this picture. It looked like a barium type of thing, she said. And then we went home, and for three kind of gut-wrenching nights and days, we just waited to find out how he was doing. She said, you know, they might have to operate, but, you know, sturdy as Bentley is, he was able to pass the sand and recovered. So now the moral of the story is twofold. Kind of first, in my eagerness to obtain the perfect shot, I ignored the actions that were right in front of me. You know, Bentley eating the sand and imitating, copying Eugene and his sifting for a treasure. So my lesson was pay attention to everything that's occurring before me. Second, they say that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, but for Bentley, it's not the safest.
Well, it's interesting that Roy's story would be about photography, because on Twitter yesterday, just before I sat down to write, I spied this message from Eric Stengel. And Eric Stengel, I mean, first of all, I had to think, why do I even follow this person on Twitter? He's one of the head writers on the David Letterman show. And he wrote in all caps, which says something, "What do you people do with all those stupid pictures you take?" That was what he wrote. And I suppose I could have ignored him, thinking that he was talking to someone else, not me. But I am one of those people who takes all those pictures. I tend to think they're not stupid. And one needs to take a bunch in order to get a good one. But I guess if you come from the perspective that looking around these days, there are lots of people taking a lot more photos than in decades past. Photography as a hobby or a practice, a spiritual practice or a tool for creating community, might just seem a bit ridiculous. Again, it's all in the perspective, right? What we think is important, what we do with it, what we save or what we throw away. I know that somebody on one of these has something that they represented something that they threw away. So that might be why, and you'll have to figure out which thing that is, right? I'd rather consider the thoughts of Dorothea Lange, the great photographer of the early 20th century, whose most famous photograph is titled Migrant Mother, Nipomo, California. Do you know what photograph I'm talking about? That's that haunting setting of the woman and her three children, distracted and anxious and exhausted looking. Lange says, while there is perhaps a province in which the photograph can tell us nothing more than what we see with our own eyes, there is another in which it proves to us how little our eyes permit us to see. But it isn't just photography that can allow this. Perhaps it's our attitude that can either permit or exclude a perspective other than the one we might normally carry. So today, the children have coloring papers with various perspective and illusions, and I'm sorry that I didn't pass these out to everybody because they're super neat, but I wanted you to listen. And I even asked somebody, I said, oh, maybe everyone should get these. And someone said, but they're not going to pay any attention. They'll be coloring. I should have, because my favorite one is the elephant. So you're going to have to come look at it afterwards. Can you see it from this far away? Just looks like an elephant, right? And the instructions are color the elephant with crayons or colored pencils, making sure to stay within the lines. Yeah, so I just kept looking and looking, and I thought, well, what's the deal? I guess it's a little blurry on the edge. Is that the issue, that really there's no real line there? But no, I just kept going in my mind, and I'm coloring and coloring. But then as you look down the legs, oopsie, you look down the leg and to the bottom, and all of a sudden the feet are over there. But wait a minute. Yeah, it gets really more complicated the more you look at it. The rest of them are somehow similar. I showed a moving picture from my computer to the folks at our planning meeting this last week. The woman was seen turning. She was standing there with her arms outstretched and her leg like this, and spinning. And she was either spinning clockwise or counterclockwise, and whichever way you saw it, right, Stuart, determined whether, did we see it different? We saw it differently. And then we saw it both ways. It determined, what they said, whether you were right-brained, which we call, say, for right-brained, that's maybe artistically minded, or left-brained, or that's considered more logical or analytical, or whether you were able to switch between the two, whether she would go this way and then all of a sudden stop and start going the other direction. So does that help us in our reframing? And reframing our ability to see things differently, whether we're right-brained or left-brained, or we try to switch between the two, not just the things on paper or the view of our sight, but situations or meanings, opportunities. The glass is too big for its contents, right, Doris?
Yes.
It is. Or I keep thinking, but maybe it needs to get filled up with something else. Therapists use this as a tool. The idea of reframing means to present an alternative possible explanation, an interpretation or perception of an experience, going beyond reflective listening. If I say, I hear you say that your teen is unruly or unmanageable, but reframing might say, I'm hearing you say that your teen is independent or strong-willed. Now, I'm squishing this example, right, into a quick sentence when in reality your therapist would likely take time and respond with empathy to the struggles that the client that you were having. But if we can think about offering a different perspective ourselves, we might come out ahead, or at least with less rigidity than we had before we looked at our own dilemma. We get stuck. Heck, that might be the reason that we ended up at the therapist's office in the first place. We make change. We find perspective after pain or sorrow, sometimes after forced loss. We also can reframe on our own out of intentionally stepping back, taking time away like a vacation, taking a new route home, or seeking a different destination. It's built right into our way in religion to see things differently, but even we can get stuck or have only one way of looking at things. It's good that we should be tested by each other, by a religious leader, by something greater than ourselves, in greater than even animal or human form. Today we're reflecting back on the summer, a season that's largely behind us, and we've gathered little bits of tokens to represent us, to represent where we've been, or what's important, or how it is that we see our journey. You have already stepped up to leave something, and I hope that you'll be able to leave it for the keys. You probably are going to want to take those home. But if you're able to leave what you've brought for a couple weeks, we'll use it again in worship so that when we have our official coming together on when we bring our water on September 8th, I believe it is, we'll use that there. We'll create the altar with those things as part of it as we mingle those activities and events and mementos into our mingling of waters. So I'll ask you, before you leave this room today, this sanctuary, to take a walk, if you haven't already, past the other stations other than the ones where you've left yours, and see what has been left there as an invitation, a possibility for you for these last few weeks of summer that you might discover by seeing things through someone else's eyes, that there is even more beauty, more memories, more ways to look at things. And maybe you might even recognize this tablescape again when seen sometime in the future, used differently as we make our way into the liturgy of the church year with all of its colors. May it be so. Amen. And blessed be.